Blog Talk Radio.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.
Good evening, everyone. This is Ken McKeon welcoming you to Nature's Talk Show and tonight's episode of The Fine Art of Paleontology. I'm joined with Ken Borman, and we are going to take you on another adventure back into the past as we talk about some really cool animals. So real quick here, say hello to Ken. Hello, Ken.
Hi, Ken. How are you tonight?
Not too bad. Not too bad. Yeah. Now, before we get underway, I do want to invite our listeners to please go to Nature's Talk Show, www.naturestalkshow.com, and get on the live chat line. You can ask questions about the show or join in with other people. We do have people joining in the chat room, and that's the only way we will field questions. We will not be taking callers on the shows anymore because there are some children out there that like think they like to call in, grown children. So if you have questions, go to the chat room and use it there. And as always, Ken is Borman is in the chat room, I believe. Aren't you, Ken?
Ready and willing to answer or to field any questions any of our listeners have.
All right. So, and tonight, I believe, Ken, with our show is kind of dedicated to one of our listeners. We love it when you guys send in requests. And one of the requests that we got in the chat room was do a show on the marine reptiles. And that's what we're going to do tonight, huh, Ken?
Yes, we're going to be looking at the plesiosaurs.
And this is a fascinating group of animals. They get, as you mentioned, I think, right before the show, Ken, a lot of people do think they're dinosaurs. But they're not dinosaurs at all. They're a group of diapsids that seem to have diverged their earliest ancestors before the archosauromorphs diverged in the early Triassic. I think we can trace some of the oldest ancestors of the plesiosaurs almost 205 million years ago.
Wow, that's a long time ago. That would predate a lot of the dinosaur lines, wouldn't it?
It does, yes. That's right after the Permian Triassic extinction event, you know.
All right, so they're one of the lines that took advantage of the hole, so to speak, I guess.
You know what? I'm wrong about that. 205 million. Yeah, I believe I'm. No, that's right. 300, 250. No, that's still up into the Upper Triassic, I believe. Yeah. Well, that's plesiosaurs. I'm sorry. That's my mistake there, folks. The plesiosaurs first appeared during about 205 million years ago, but their earliest ancestors appeared right after the Permian Triassic, the Sauropterygia. And we need to talk a little bit about these here. But, you know, before we get going on this here and talking about their ancestry and stuff, one of the, I think, iconic images that we have, Ken, in the modern age here about plesiosaurs, and that's the Loch Ness Monster. What do you think?
The first time I saw that thing, I was very young, obviously, because that photo's been around for longer than me, and that's saying something. But the first thing I thought, that's a plesiosaur. But then, of course, it wasn't.
Yeah. It's interesting that one of the most famous photographs that was circulated for a long time and used as, you know, proof that Nessie was real, and I believe that was taken back in the 30s by a doctor and his son, I believe. They made a little dinosaur kind of thingy. You know, it's interesting when you look at I'm spitting words out tonight, everybody. But when you look at a reconstruction of a plesiosaur, and they have a longer, thinner neck, I think his reconstruction actually looked like a brontosaur.
Yeah, it would have been closer to that, or one of the relatives, I guess. There were some that had pretty long necks, weren't there?
There's one of the latest last genera, the elasmosaurids, the last type. They had very long necks, and we'll definitely be talking about that group here shortly because it's got an interesting tail that goes with the elasmosaurus and its relatives. But it's interesting, you know. But for a long, you know, we seem to have a, you know, hope that we will find stuff living from the past. You know, when the coelacanth was discovered back in the 1930s, you know, it gave a glimmer that there were other prehistoric animals. You know, and Nessie, I believe, what, Mbolo and Boki or something, and Becky. Doggone it, I can't remember the name of that of the African creature that was thought to be.
Yeah, I just associated something. Maybe the discovery of the coelacanth prompted the doctor to pull that hoax in Loch Ness.
Yeah, isn't that amazing?
By you mentioning them both together, maybe that was why he did it. Who knows?
Yeah. But it's funny about hoaxes, you know, when over the years in paleontology, there have been a lot of hoaxes done. And some of them have caused some interesting paleontologists in the past to be discredited because of what they how they believe some of these hoaxes. I believe Piltdown Man was one of them. A hoax that some students did on a professor in England back in the 1800s, you know? So anyway, I don't know why anybody would want to do a hoax myself, you know? I mean, there's fun times to play a joke and practical jokes. I like joking and playing practical jokes myself, but when it comes to scientific discovery and stuff like this, it's so much nicer to have the real thing because the real thing, you know, it just, how do I want to say this, Ken? I like credibility. And I would hate to have my name, you know, associated with, you know, to be discredited because I would hoax a fossil or something. I had somebody ask me one time if we took bones out to plant them. And so I was like, are you out of your mind?
There is another topic. Along that same topic that you're talking about, I got an email from one of our listeners who actually says, hi Ken, so every once in a while you come across a rendering of a plesiosaur being attacked by a tyrannosaur. Now these examples, he sent me a couple of photos actually, one a cover of a book on prehistoric animals by William E. Hill, and then another looked like early 20th century illustration. And he says, these two examples are from pretty old books, granted, but is there any truth in their inspiration?
That's a very good question.
Yeah. So what say you, Ken?
Well, what we know about Tyrannosaurus rex, for one thing, it only lived in a short period of time at the end of the Cretaceous, and most of the plesiosaurs had died out. They were already extinct. So probably the only ones that were surviving up to that time would have been the elasmosaurid type, and those particular plesiosaurs, their necks were not structured to be held above the water, so they would not have been able to come up on land. Now,
right.
So they were fully open ocean marine reptiles. You know, they swam through probably large groups out through the different seas around the Cretaceous period, and they probably didn't come into contact with land. Now, the thing about, like, the Tyrannosaurus rex and some of the others, these dinosaurs, we have to remember that during the Cretaceous period, in the last part when T. rex lived, there was an inland sea that covered part of New Mexico, or North America.
Mm-hmm.
It split North America into two, small units, a western one and the eastern one. Unfortunately, in the east, there's not very many deposits available. A lot of it eroded off during subsequent years. I believe a lot of it was above. How do I want to say it? It was an erosional surface for much of the Mesozoic period. So that's why we see a lot of lower Paleozoic deposits, like in your area. You know, we see the Devonian, Silurian, Ordovician, you know, consecutively older in those parts. And that was above water. There wasn't probably too much deposition. Now, out here on the western western side of the Seaway, we have a lot of good deposits. And we know that T-Rex actually was more of a inland type of animal. It did not appear to get down to the ocean much at all. So that's probably just a artistic license. Now, they did believe once upon a time that the plesiosaurs come upon land to lay their eggs, but as it's since been demonstrated through fossils, that the more than likely they had living young. They gave birth to live young, so that they did not need. And when we look at the plesiosaurs, we see physically that they couldn't have come up on shore to have been battling a T-Rex. And T-Rex, being an inland dinosaur, probably never ventured into the surf. You know, no beach days for T-Rex.
Right. Yeah.
So, now, yeah, I believe you had another question from our listeners, didn't you, Ken?
Yes. We've got a question from the chat room. It says, "Hi, Ken, what about the really long-necked plesiosaurs? Wasn't that neck just an invite to be chopped in half by a mosasaur? It seems that they would have had so little protection against the large predators."
Once again, a good question. Now, what we see in the fossil record a lot of times are on bones where other seagoing reptiles have attacked the different plesiosaurs over the years, ichthyosaurs, all kinds of different animals. The larger pliosaurs during the Jurassic period, they preyed upon each other, kind of so to speak. When we look at some of the big pliosaurs like Lyopleurodon, you know, they were probably feeding upon some of their smaller members of their related plesiosaurs that was living with them in the Jurassic seas. I think when we're looking at the Cretaceous period, I think what we're seeing mostly are mosasaurs, which I don't know if they were numerous enough to have really caused a dent in these elasmosaurs. Obviously, probably not, since they seem to have been a successful group. Since there were other animals for these things to feed on too, but I believe they have been in the. When we come down to it, there are records showing mosasaur teeth bites on a lot of these fossils we find.
Right, so that wouldn't have helped them live a very long life, would it?
But they, I don't know how much predation was going on with all. There was a number of animals, you know, living in the Cretaceous seas. So large fishes and things, you know. So matter of fact, coming up on a couple shows from now, you and I are going to discuss the inland sea during the Cretaceous and the life forms that lived in it involved, because it's an amazing sea. And we'll talk about more on the predators that was living alongside the plesiosaurs at the time.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's great.
But
all right, so I hope that answers the questions for you listeners. And if you've got any other questions, bring them out.
Yeah, definitely keep them coming. Now let's go back in time and talk a little bit about the origins of the plesiosaurs, because we as we see evolution, you know, all these groups start out somewhere. A morph or something in a certain population, and these populations, if the morph, also called a mutation, if it happens, it's and it's beneficial to the overall population, it'll spread through the population. And I believe sometimes now one of the things I like about evolution, Ken, is that it's predictable. You know, we can see that mutations occur, just randomly. You know, it appears to be randomly, but there is a pattern that seems to be developing as we look at it. And it's like a species lives approximately 2 million years or so. The genus will live longer, but the species outlook is just for a short period of time, because overall mutations, population dynamics, et cetera, cause changes to happen fairly rapidly. And it seems like when a morph goes through one of these populations, it takes about 10,000 generations, if it's a good one, to become the dominant morph. Now, that's kind of fascinating, I think.
It is, actually. You've mentioned that 2 million years before, but it is interesting on your generational information there.
Yeah, so we can see how, you know, fast evolution works, and since we know evolution can work this fast, that is really why we don't see a whole lot of completely, you know, intermediate forms. It's only on certain conditions, certain animals, that we can see that, like some of the marine invertebrates especially. We can see good deposits where we have good succession of millions and millions of years where we can see these dynamics, you know, occurring. So that's kind of fascinating, you know. And but there's another interesting thing about evolution, too, and it's I always say this on our show here. It's one of my favorites, and that's called convergence.
Mm-hmm.
And when we look out through, you know, we see every, I guess you can say, tetrapod creature that's returned to the sea has started out on land. Now, it's interesting, you know, that the earliest ancestors, you know, they moved onto land, you know, to take advantage of the terrestrial, you know, habitats and environments and food sources, et cetera. And, of course, you know, the tetrapods exploded, you know. And but it's always fascinating, you know, when you see one of these creatures going back to the sea and how much they, you know, as we look through the different organisms, converge. To me, one of the best dynamics of convergence is looking at the ichthyosaurs from the, you know, involved in Triassic, and we look at the modern dolphins.
Right. Yeah.
Beautiful convergence, and and what we have seen too is habitat puts pressures on creatures, and that's why we see sometimes two separate groups of animals will show a lot of, you know, similarities, even though they're not related, and that's usually environmental pressures put selective pressures on certain traits that are advantageous for that particular habitat. It's like having the
actually,
proper tools for the proper job.
Yeah, actually, something you just had me thinking. You said earlier that it seems that the plesiosaurs birth to live young. Do we know if that's a trait that they developed whilst living in the sea, or did their ancestors, who came from the land, have that trait already established? Do we know that?
Well, it appears that when we look back at the earliest sauropterygians, make sure I got that right. Yeah, lizard flippers. The sauropterygians are a group of animals that they're the first ones that diverged from the terrestrial ancestors, and they appeared to have longer, starting out with longer flippers on the end of legs. They hadn't quite lost their legs yet. Their toes were starting, you know, to grow. So we start seeing in these animals that where they were basically land animals. Some of them could even probably return fairly easily to the land and back and forth. We do know their evolution seems to have been somewhere in, I believe, the South China area.
All right.
That because we see some of the original Sauropterygian land ancestors there, then we start seeing around the coast. These things probably were coastal, you know, reptiles. And started feeding on sea creatures. Now, I think there's a good example of something that can happen modern or in the future if they don't become extinct because of human interference, and that is the marine iguana.
Right.
Yeah. I imagine now one of the problems that the marine iguana has in far as development is that it's lives in a cool part of the ocean. The current, I think, that comes up around the Galapagos Islands where these organisms live is kind of cold. So these things go from coming out on land, you know, to warm up and stuff to moving back into a colder environment. And that probably puts a little bit of hindrance on their evolutionary development. You know, how soon would they go back, you know, return into a fully aquatic animal?
Right. But because that has a problem with reproduction in their instance, wouldn't they?
I'd say you know, slow reproduction rate with those particular reptiles. Now, when we start seeing these sauropterygians as they start developing, there are several different groups, like the pliosaurs. The nothosaurs was one of the early ones. There was another group here. The pistosaurs. Interestingly enough, when we look at these earlier ancestors, like those reptiles, they look like miniature versions of what they were to become. Although each of these groups, of course, had their different, anatomical, differences. Different differences.
Right.
not too scientific there. But anyway, their morphology, you know, each one showing the where their line evolved to a certain extent. But I think it's when we look at the, which one did I say it was? The pistosaurs? Is that the one that evolved eventually into the plesiosaurs? We'll get back to that one in a minute, though. But, okay, here we go. Now, when we look at their evolution from these groups, you know, some of them were outpaced, I guess, evolutionary. And one of the these guys was the plesiosaurus. You know, the plesiosaurus. Plesiosaurus is probably one of the epitome of a plesiosaur.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, it's the one I believe that the Loch Ness monster, as we mentioned earlier, you know, was taken from. But
right.
Yeah. But these were a large marine, fairly large, plesiosaurs. They lived during the earliest part of the Jurassic period, plesiosaurus. Typical member. Now, one of the interesting things is a plesiosaurus, I believe, that when we look at it, a lady named Mary Anning. Are you familiar with her, Ken?
Is that the lady from England?
Yes, that's
Early paleontologist. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
Fossil hunter, but she discovered the first complete skeleton of plesiosaurus back in December of 1823. So it's almost the anniversary of when the first complete plesiosaurus skeleton was discovered.
Wow. So we've known about them for quite some time.
Yes, that's one thing about them. Yeah, they were one of the first what they called antediluvian reptiles discovered, you know, or antediluvian. I think they were thought to have died out during Noah's flood.
All right.
Yeah. And it's interesting how that myth has gotten out of hand.
Mm-hmm. Actually, Ken, is plesiosaurus, is that a genus or a species?
Plesiosaurus is a genus. I believe the species name is Brachypterygius. Brachypterygius.
Okay.
Yeah, Brachypterygius. There's also, there's several species. Am I right? No, Dolichodereus is the, I'm sorry, there's only one plesiosaurus. And that is Dolichodereus.
Oh.
I'm sorry. There
that's
we go.
Monotypic.
Monospecific. And once again, you know, this is a typical long from the neck to tail, fairly long. The body was kind of flattened a little bit, and it had large flippers. Now, when we look at some of the other ancestors in the lower and middle and upper Triassic, we see that they too were developing these flippers, long, you know, fairly long necks, and et cetera. So they kind of each of these different organisms and resembled each other. Now, I'm going to just ask our listeners out there, you know, to go and check into these, because there's a whole lot more than we're going to be able to talk about on the show, because usually this show it flies.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, we do have that problem sometimes.
Oh, this stuff is just too fun to talk about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And, doggone it. I hate when I mess myself up like that. Okay, here we go. Now, you were talking earlier about the long neck guys. That's the we need to go and talk about the Elasmosaurus.
This is a line. Is that correct?
Yeah, there's well, see, I believe they're from the Elasmosauridae. That's the family, the genus Elasmosaurus, and I believe the species E. platyurus. Now, these guys are found here out here. I believe they're in the, from the Cretaceous period, and they can be found here in New Mexico, even.
Wow.
Yeah, they lived in the Companion stage about 80.5 million years ago, and that's as the time was the time when the big Great Inland Sea, and we have the Manco Shale, I believe, which is close to that age, and the Manco Shale has Elasmosaurus or Elasmosaurus type fossils found in it. We can find the late Plesiosaurus. We can also find Mosasaur fossils, I believe, too. But there's the there's one really interesting thing that happened with this discovery of this dinosaur. Now, I believe one time on our show, didn't we talk about the bone wars between Edward
yes.
Drinker Cope and Othniel Charles Marsh?
Yes, we have.
Well, this, Ken, was the creature that actually got the war going. And back in when Marsh and Cope were... This is in the 1860s. They were trying to outdo it. There was a time of discovery, and they were trying to outdo each other. And they were naming all kinds of animals, real with just small pieces of bone. Just matter of fact, a lot of the creatures that they named were have shown to have been misidentified, etc. So with that. You know, a lot of their discoveries kind of got pushed out of the way. But they did name some stuff right. Dimetrodon was named by Cope. Elasmosaurus here was named by Cope. But do you remember what their big fight started over?
Well, isn't that like derision because one of them put the wrong end of the dinosaur on the head or something?
Yeah, well, it's kind of interesting. When Cope is the one that put the reconstruction together,
mm-hmm.
and he made several mistakes. And, of course, when he put the head on, he put the head on the short tail end of this animal, and he thought that the long neck was actually the tail. You know, yeah, and actually, yeah, Elasmosaurus has a long neck with a lot of vertebrae in it. So... when we, what he actually did was he put the head of the Elasmosaurus on the tail end, as you mentioned, and Charles Marsh happened to notice that, and he said that the head actually belonged on the tail end vertebrae, because what was interesting about the tail end vertebrae that Cope used was actually had part of the skull still attached to it.
Oh, no.
Oh, yeah, and I guess it just mortified Cope, you know, when he did that. He was just, and so, but that has been cited as one of the causes of their long-lasting and rivalry. So,
wow. It's pretty vicious, too, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And Cope supposedly republished the paper and the book with it being corrected, trying to say that I forget what he say that the mistake was made by the publisher or something like that.
Blame someone else, anyone but me.
Yeah, but at any rate, even though there's no factual justification, it's still interesting that they did have a rivalry going, and I believe they were even supposed to have been at times. One would blow up a site to keep the other from poaching it.
Wow.
Yeah, it got pretty nasty.
So these Elasmosaurs, they had the longest necks of all of them, did they?
Bet they did.
Is that correct?
That they did. Now, here's an interesting thing, too. Even though they have been shown in art to lift their head above the surface, it is known now that they cannot do that, and probably they would only raise their head above the water if they were in shallow water where it rests its body on the bottom, because the weight of the neck and muscles would have prevented Elasmosaurus from raising its neck very high anyway. It was mostly extended out in front of them.
So it's evolved fully for aquatic life, and wow.
Yeah, and basically, they couldn't bend their neck into a S shape like a swan. That was not possible. At any rate,
I guess
they could actually turn.
The only advantage to having a neck that long, I guess, would be to catch fish.
Yeah, and their teeth suggest that as well. They also probably ate belemnites, which were the Cretaceous equivalent of a squid, ammonites. And they said they swallowed small stones for digestion. Those are called gastroliths. And there's a lot of conjecture about gastroliths, you know, whether they're true or not. Dr. Spencer Lucas, from the head curator at the New Mexico Museum of Natural History, actually calls them gastromyths.
So he doesn't say whether they're a valid thing?
Yeah, he doesn't believe too much in the gastroliths thing. Now, there have been studies on extant animals. Did you know crocodiles? Crocodilians swallow stones to help them out.
I didn't know that.
Yes. Yeah, that's kind of interesting. And I've got a paper somewhere in one of the bulletins published by the New Mexico Museum of Natural History that actually talks about the study this guy did to see if they could see in the fossil record, you know, whether stones showed that they were inside a digestive tract. So
I know I give grit to all sorts of the birds I keep. They actually need it, or some of them need it to aid in their digestion.
Yeah, that's when the chicken gizzard. That's where the the gizzards where the I think they swallow the stones into, and I know that's what they help do is grind up their grain in some of the, like the chickens, you know.
Mm.
They like the teeth.
Yeah, a lot of the small parrots, I know we've got to give credit to them.
Mm-hmm.
So they must utilize it that same way.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, it is kind of wild in the fossil record. There's only been just a teeny tiny handful of instances where they've thought that they were gastroliths.
Mm-hmm.
And there are certain things that have to be done to prove that it is a gastrolith. And usually that's where they have to find the stones inside the rib cage where they would have been when the animal was alive.
Right.
And one of the problems that they have had is stones that were thought to be gastroliths were the way they were distributed around some of the fossils. Seismosaurus is a good example here in New Mexico of where they were thought to have had gastroliths. And but the deposition, the way the stones are distributed, et cetera, probably show that they're not. It's just, stones in the sand.
Right.
So,
oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, but these guys were thought to have said small stones too. So I'd like to look more into that myself and see about that. But at any rate, when it comes to the Elasmosaurus and some of these other plesiosaurs lifting their neck above the water, they couldn't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But artists. It's nice to see that modern artists are trying to take that into account anymore.
Yeah, I think they're going more for realism these days, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the earlier artists actually strived for.
Well, what's really happened over the years, too, Ken, is forensics has helped us to realize that some of the earlier way these animals were mounted was wrong. Some of the sauropods.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times when we see reconstructions of them, it shows the tail dragging the ground and then the head and neck, raised up a little bit. But it appears that once we start looking at them, that they, once again, the tails were straight out behind them and their necks were fairly straight out in front of them. They didn't really raise their neck up high or anything. They just stretched more out. And I think we're seeing that now when we see some of the, mounts of Diplodocus.
Right.
Get that dinosaur out.
mm-hmm.
Now, if one wanted to go and hunt for some of these animals, I would think just coming out to where exposures of the Western Interior Seaway, like in Kansas, the Niobrara Chalk. Here we have the Manco Shale, and you can find some of these, later plesiosaurs.
Actually, Ken, there's one thing we haven't really said. How big were these buggers?
Oh, yeah. How big did some of these guys get? Well, plesiosaurus, I think when we look at its size, how big did plesiosaurus get? I think most of them were around up to 10 meters long. I think that'd be about 33 feet for some of the plesiosaurus. The elasmosaurus, let's see here. Figures, I don't have their size in, available. But I think the elasmosaurus, they got pretty good size with their long neck. They grew up to 14 meters.
All right.
Yeah, that was at the end of the Cretaceous. Now, the earliest Elasmosaurid was about 3 meters long.
Mm-hmm.
But now, when we look at some of the other, not the plesiosaurs, but the pliosaurs, when we look at some of the pliosaurs, they, too, got pretty good size. Let's see here. Which, if we can talk about here, I see a Kronosaurus was one of the large predators. Let's see. Kronosaurus was a pliosaur. The pliosaurs, which are different from the plesiosaurs, they're the short-necked plesiosaurs.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, they had the short neck because there were two types. And now when we look at some of the size links here on some of the short-necked plesiosaurs here, like Kronosaurus, they actually grew to about 9 to 10 meters.
But it was the whole body.
Yeah, the whole body. Liopleurodon here, I believe Liopleurodon, it also, let's see here, when we look at the length of it, it grew to probably approximately, largest known was just a little over 10 meters.
All right.
And, yeah, so it appears that when we looked at, Walking with Dinosaurs, and it was talking about some of this, they had the animals actually oversized.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were... it kind of blew it up. Now, it's kind of funny when we, over the last year, when we've been doing a lot of this research here for the show, and seeing when Walking with Dinosaurs mentioned, they really made a lot of mess ups on this on their show. I've noticed misnaming creatures and stuff. It's like, oh, guys, come on, we don't need that. Yeah, there on Walking with Dinosaurs, they. Claim Liopleurodon grew to about 25 meters.
Wow, that's huge.
And That's yeah, that's longer than my house is wide here.
Yeah.
You know, so but 82 feet, but that definitely considered an error. But one interesting thing about these animals is it appears that their skull on these Lyopleurids is approximately 1/7 of their measurement, and I think on some of it might have been 1/5 of the body length. Yeah, 1/5 of the body length is what the Kronosaurus and Lyopleurodon skull appears to be. And so we're looking at skulls approximately 1.5 meters long.
That's still a hefty animal, isn't it?
It's a 5-foot skull, you know, when you picture that teeth and stuff in it, you know. But now, Lyopleurodon and Kronosaurus, those, are, I believe, are Jurassic creatures.
Right.
And, of course, now during the Jurassic period is when the plesiosaurs had their heyday, I guess you could say. There were more genera and species and stuff at that time than in the Triassic or the Cretaceous period.
Now, did these die out at KT?
Yes.
All right, so that was the end of them.
That was
everything.
It.
Wow.
Yeah, they started downward trend. Now, interestingly enough, the ichthyosaurs died out before the end of the Cretaceous, and mm-hmm. there was a form. I'm not sure if I have it on hand here, but there was a one of these plesiosaurs actually started showing convergence and shaping itself kind of similar to the ichthyosaurs.
Wow.
Yeah, so they were filling in a niche left over. Evidently, that niche is very important, as we see today with the modern, dolphins that have
right.
filled in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, interestingly, Ken, there's some evidence that these plesiosaurs might have been warm-blooded.
How can we arrive at that possibility, Ken?
Well, they believe that they were able to reach some pretty good speeds on some of these fast hunters, especially with the plesiosaur build. And with their having living young, they believe that that was one of the things. But now I'm not too sure about that. I'm just saying that some paleontologists believe that they were warm-blooded.
Interesting concept is that might answer a few questions if they were, might not.
Yeah. Well, they lived in most of the seas, so that's kind of interesting too, you know. Yeah. Let's see here. What else can we say about these creatures, you know?
Well, very successful, obviously, for a long time.
Yeah.
And it needed an extinction event to sound the death knell for them, I guess. But it's a long time for them to be around, isn't it?
Yeah, when you look at their, overall evolutionary, development, Ken, they really spread out across the seas, and there's quite a number of when you look at the genera you check out a cladogram, you know, and you start seeing all the different ones from the plesiosauria, the pliosaurids, you know, so there's a very interesting, and these are, when you look at this one, there's several, it just shows some of the families and orders. They show a real nice diversification. I believe there's something like, how many species have been named? I had that down earlier, how many different types, but maybe I'll come across it again here.
So they're fairly common in the fossil record?
Well, I guess this is about as common as any animal, you know. One thing interesting about these animals here is they lived in water. And when you have animals that live in water, there's a chance of things getting buried a lot, you know, a lot quicker. We find most, even terrestrial fossils, usually have to fall into a lake, a pond, a stream, or a river, you know, mm-hmm. and get buried by sand or something. And one of the things we find when we're out here, as we're looking through the Manco Shale, too, is we'll see layers of sand throughout the shale layers that represent storm surges that was happening not too far from the eastern coast of the western continent, or the western landmass.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually not too far to the west of me. So when we look at some of these sand deposits, we find shark teeth, and we'll find plesiosaur teeth in them as well.
Wow.
And here in New Mexico, we do find the elasmosaurids in the Cretaceous. So I believe my brother found a tooth of one not too long ago, or it's been a couple years now since we were collecting in this one area.
And
so I hope
do you have any in your museum, Ken?
Only in the back room.
Ah, right. So nothing on display.
Nothing on display, but the specimens, most of the specimens that we do have in our museum are only partial pieces of skeletons, just for the most part, isolated teeth, vertebrae, ribs, and like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, one of the problems that we have with fossils, you know, complete skeletons are so rare. You know, we see these beautiful complete skeletons, and a lot of times, what we have is where they've taken several partial skeletons and put them together, or, of course, modern museums now, very rarely is there a real dinosaur skeleton actually on display.
Right.
You know, they're models. So they're able to take and mold the bones, you know, and get complete skeletons now by using several partial skeletons. But every now and then, you get lucky like Ann Manning did and discover, you know, a complete fossil.
Mm-hmm.
And now, one of the things about trying to find something like that here in New Mexico, it just takes a lot of getting out and walking the Cretaceous exposures. And, Ken, there's a lot of Cretaceous exposed here in New Mexico.
Well, that's why we need younger legs, huh?
That's it. Yeah, well, my old legs are getting where they can't quite hike as far as they used to, and some of those hillsides are getting pretty steep anymore. You know, they weren't so steep a few years ago. And now, one of the things I feel kind of sad about here in North America is that early Triassic and Middle Triassic exposures are gone. We do not have them here in the Southwest and the western part of the country. There was a big hiatus during the late Permian and up to the late Triassic. So we here in New Mexico, we've got like a 20 million year gap in the rock record.
Why is that, Ken?
It was evidently towards the middle part of the Permian instead. Or during the Triassic period, this was an erosional surface. It was above, and it was weathered. Mm-hmm. And any deposit that was there by the time of the late Triassic was gone, then during the late Triassic, conditions changed. And New Mexico and surrounding states like Texas, we became a depositional zone again. And we have the upper Triassic. And unfortunately, for my collecting here in the Triassic in New Mexico, it's all terrestrial. We don't have any marine Triassic here. You have to go to the East Coast, I think, to find anything like that. But anywhere Triassic, the inland seas from the Triassic to the Cretaceous, shallow seas where we had high water stands during periods of non-glaciation, you can find many different plesiosaur skeletons around the world. Their fossils do occur everywhere.
And they're a fairly well-storied marine reptile too, aren't they? I almost said dinosaur, then I almost fell into that trap too. But so I guess there would be quite owned, as you suggested, but there'd be certainly either restorations or models in a lot of the museums around the place for our listeners to go and have a look at, wouldn't they?
I would hope so, yeah. It's been a long time since I've been to a really big museum. I got to visit the Smithsonian back in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And they have one of the nicest paleontology displays ever. I'd recommend anybody around the world, you know, everybody around the world, try to get to the Smithsonian Institute. I've also been to the Field Museum in Chicago. That's another great museum, you know, that I recommend. New Mexico Museum of Natural History is a very nice museum, but it's kind of small. We don't have a huge dinosaur collection on display, but we got some very nice displays, and they've been working on the Paleozoic era, which, of course, is my favorite era. I love the Paleozoic.
I'll have to see if I can take you to the Rum when you come up here.
Yeah, yeah.
Royal Ontario Museum. It's got a fairly substantial collection, I believe.
You know, what's cool is I should be able to get into the back room there.
Well, I'll carry your bags.
Yeah, we'll go in there and talk to them. And since I am from the New Mexico Museum of Natural History, you know, I'm a full research associate for our listeners. That is a fun position to be in. Research associate means that I study and collect fossils for the museum. And one of the things that come with is I get the chance to go into any museum around the world and study their fossils. So it's really great being part of the New Mexico Museum of Natural History staff.
Excellent.
Yeah, one of the benefits.
So you're going to have to come up early so we can hit the room.
Yeah. And I'll definitely bring my papers work with me. So I'm looking forward to seeing what they have there, you know. But anyway, the plesiosaurs, they're a very interesting group of reptiles. They're not a dinosaur. They had a very full evolutionary history. And I would recommend to our listeners out there, you know, definitely dig in more than we covered on the show. We just barely grazed these animals, so to speak. You know, there's a lot more to learn. There's there are collecting areas for those who want to travel a little bit. The Niobrara Chalk in Kansas is a real good place to look for fossils. Now, one thing to remember about collecting these fossils like this, these are vertebrates, and many states have laws on collecting vertebrate fossils. It's not permitted. Because they go to science. And also, although you can collect invertebrate fossils in state parks and different places around the country, you cannot collect vertebrate fossils. So if these fossils are on private land, you can get permission from the landowner to collect fossils. One of the things about being a research associate at the museum, Ken, is I get to collect on government land. I can collect it on BLM land out here, or we get permits where I'm actually covered on some of the permits where I can collect on federal lands here in New Mexico. So that's one thing about working for a museum is being covered by their permits. But I do have permission from a lot of landowners, too, to do my Permian research. One of the things that we do as paleontologists is we work with a lot of private owners out there. So get permission before you go on the private property, and good luck hunting.
Excellent. Well, it sounds like there's plenty of places around where you can possibly find yourself a little bit of plesiosaur.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely here in New Mexico. There's a lot of great exposures of the Cretaceous Mancos Shale from quite a bit of exposures, actually. I think we go back to the early Cretaceous here with some of our marine deposits, Ken. So, some of the real early stuff. So we do have these marine reptiles in the fossil record here in New Mexico. And hopefully this coming summer, we do plan on trying to get back up to some of the Cretaceous deposits and look for some more of these reptiles, because Lasmosaurus and Mosasaur are two marine reptiles of the Cretaceous that are on my bucket list to find, along with some pterosaurs, because we do have pterosaurs fossils in the interior seaway deposits.
I guess you're not collecting much these days.
What's that?
I guess you're not collecting much with the weather the way it is for you. I believe it's snowing and all down there.
Well, it's turned winter here in New Mexico right now.
Yeah,
the ground's covered with snow. That's one time, my brother and I, many years ago, we decided we were going to take a trip from Albuquerque up to the northwest corner to do some dinosaur hunting. And it was snowing, barely snowing in Albuquerque. And as we started driving north, it started snowing harder and snowing harder. Well, about 50 miles or 45 miles northwest of Albuquerque is a little town called Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And there's about 3-4 inches of snow on the ground. We're telling ourselves, like, look, it's going to break before, you know, by the time we start getting on up the highway, by the time we get up to the Misty Badland area, which is like a 3.5-hour, 4-hour drive from Albuquerque. We said, we'll drive out of it, except it kept getting worse. Now, what was funny is we decided to stop at a little convenience market to grab a soda or something, you know, and kind of think about it. Next thing you know, we're spinning around out of control, up over the curb, boom, up, and right into a parking spot.
Oh, my goodness.
So we kind of look at each other, get out, we go in, grab us a soda, come back out, and he said, you know what, I think it's time to go back south. So we turned around, went south, and then we went south of Albuquerque, and the weather cleared up completely. We was in bright sunshine. So, but yeah, it took us bumping over a curb to figure out, you know, we're not going to be hunting in snow.
No, it's not advised, is it?
On good weather, it'll be coming back. You know what's really cool, too, for our listeners out there to think about this here? It's only just about 90 more days of winter left that coming up here, and we'll be back in the springtime.
Yep. And springtime's a good thing of all the weathering that's occurred, hasn't it?
In springtime, it's great because you get the spring rains that come in. They start washing the mud and stuff that's broke up during the wintertime, so you start getting out. And we like going out then because there's all kinds of brand-new stuff that's been weathered out from the rocks. So we'll be definitely hitting the areas that are coming this spring here. I'll try to be getting back to my Permian research because we got some cool animals we want to discover. You know. So, here we are, Ken, once again, up at the top of the hour.
Yep. Yeah, except on again.
Well,
so what's our show going to be next week? Next week, Ken.
Ken, I think we got a cool show. Now, I know we've grazed on this coming up, but I want to have a full-blown show where we talk about the invasion of the land. And we'll start with the plants, and then we want to talk about the insects, the Eurypterids, which became part of the arachnotype. And then we'll talk about the invasion of the tetrapods, because there's some interesting stuff as we talk about these different creatures and what it took to invade the land. There's some things that had to happen with the planet Earth first before animals and plants could come up on shore. So we'll talk about some of those changes that had to happen. And then on the 28th here, the week after that, you and I are going to take another adventure to the Cretaceous period, Ken. We're going to go explore the great inland sea that covered North America, part of it.
Excellent.
So we'll be talking about some really great animals, and from fish to cephalopods to the pterosaurs that flew overhead. So there were birds that lived in the seas. We'll have to talk about some of those amazing, interesting birds, you know, the marine reptiles, ichthyosaurs and plesiosaurs and different things. So we're going to have a great time as you and I go paddling about in the great inland sea.
That's great. I'm looking forward to that.
And now we haven't sat down and talked about our new shows for next year, but Ken and I, you and I, are going to take our adventure listeners on, I think, some really great trips next year. I got some really cool in-depth animals I think you and I should explore, some great sites around the world I think we should check out for our listeners, and it'll be a fun trip, Ken.
Excellent.
All right.
Lots to look forward to.
All right. Very cool.
Oh, but wait a second. Speaking of fun trips, you know what? We have a huge announcement to make. Should we wait till after the first of the year, Ken? Ken Borman and Ken McKeon?
It's just around the corner.
Yeah, we'll wait then. We'll wait. We'll wait till a little bit closer. Yeah. But what I do, something really important, is to tell everyone to follow us on Blog Talk, please. Go to blogtalkradio.com/Nature's Talk Show and click on that follow button. We would love it if you would do that for us. And if you want to put our player on your website, you can do that with the RSS feed. There's lots of things you can do, okay? So there you go, Ken. And Ken, I'll let you guys close it out.
All right, thank you.
Thank you very much, Mary.
Yeah, now, we do want to invite everybody to, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show, to visit Nature's Talk Show at www.naturestalkshow.com for the website. Check out and sign up for our newsletter as well. Visit our store. We have all kinds of great things there for you to buy and support Nature's Talk Show. Visit our chat room, as we mentioned at the beginning of the show. Ken is in there to help field questions to us. And also, leave your ideas for us, because Ken, Mary, and I, we will be sure to get them on the air here. We love doing that for you. Go back and listen to our archive shows. Ken and I have several years now here doing the fine art of paleontology, and we've got some great shows archived, so you'll really enjoy those. With that there, I want to say thank you to our listeners. Thank you very much, Ken, for another fun chat.
It's a pleasure.
Oh, it's just a blast, and we got another good show coming up here in a few days. For our listeners out there, if you want to come to find out some other stuff that Ken and I talk about, come join us on the 18th when we have tank topics, because Ken and I are also well-known aquarists from around the world, so that'll be fun as well. So anyway, thank you for our listeners out there. Thank you, Mary, Ken, and everybody. And join us here next time on Nature's Talk Show. I'll shut up so you guys can have a good evening. Bye-bye.
Good night from me.
Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and listen to us at www.naturestalkshow.com.